your reaction to yesterday's meeting with the Syrian president. He's agreed to enter into a coalition to fight ISIS and terrorism and generally stabilize the region in return for reduction of sanctions from the U.S. and playing along economically for his citizens' own benefit. Bashar al-Assad would never have done this. And I didn't think in my lifetime we'd ever see a step toward this type of agreement, as limited as it may be, in my lifetime, considering Syria being Syria. Your reaction to the development from yesterday, sir?
I got to say I'm torn, and I'm gonna hold my judgment until we see what happens in time, because
clearly
we can't lose sight of the fact that just a few months ago this guy was had a $10 million I think reward on his head by the U.S. government for terrorist activities that he had done, and he is part of al-Nusra, is part of ISIS, and several others what we considered terrorist groups, and then he has a change of heart. Now, I am all about doing what makes sense for our country. And if we can make a deal with somebody that increases our security, that causes us to be able to redeploy and leave troops behind that we have in Syria right now, which I'm told by a certain member of the administration just days ago that that is the case, that we are planning to remove all of our troops from Syria by September of 2026. Big time supporter of that.
Yes.
If this works and if it holds and if it brings peace and help to the people of Syria and reduces our exposure in the region, then it's a great thing, and I'm all for it.
Well, I guess it's like the Italians getting rid of Mussolini and getting away from the Axis powers before World War II is over. Maybe he realized he's on the losing side, and this growing coalition of what I'll boil down to in the idea of the Abraham Accords, let's play nice together for our own mutual benefit and put aside our differences. Maybe he just sees that is the future for the region. This is where my optimism comes from, Daniel Davis. Maybe it's false.
Yeah, well, look, self-interest is definitely at play here. And if we know anything at all about a lot of the way things work in the Arab world for decades, and you could probably go back centuries, the friend of my friend, a friend of my enemy is my friend. And if he sees a benefit to work together with us today, he can do it. And if things change 2 years from now, he'll do that too. And, we certainly can't forget the time when we had during the Sons of Iraq, during our big problem that we had with them during the 2005-07 period. All of a sudden, for reasons that made sense to them on the ground, they joined forces with us after having been fighting us the day before. And then all of a sudden, now that we're their friends, we're giving them money, and that dramatically reduced the amount of violence against the American troops that eventually paved the way for us to leave our combat troops there, at least for a period of time. So it can work, but you have to understand it's a transient thing, and the minute that things change for them, they'll change on the other side. So we have to always keep a wary eye on that.
Well, back to your concept before when the Russians had invaded Afghanistan, we cuddled up with the Mujahideen and some of the other just because they were against the Russians. And then
how'd that work out a decade later?
Once we go to Afghanistan, I hate to laugh over that tragedy, but there's another illustration of your point. The enemy of my enemy is my friend until the other enemy is not there anymore. Daniel Davis, let us move over. Apparently, I see the headline, we are losing Pokrovsk, Russia nears biggest gain since Bakhmut. This morning, and that obviously means territorial gains to the advantage of the Russians, but also on the heels of, and we experienced our first winter blast here in the greater Cincinnati area. It's down to the 20s, and we had to deal with some snow on the ground. That happened on the same day I read about Russia hitting a lot of Ukrainians' power sources, ultimately resulting in zero power or energy, which I perceive to be as freezing Ukrainians. So amid all this, what's your assessment of the situation between those two countries?
Yeah, the situation in Pokrovsk is almost completely gone. The city of Pokrovsk itself is all but gone. There's just a few outlying neighborhoods and groupings of buildings on the very far outskirts on the north and northeastern quadrants of the city. The bigger issue is that there are some number of thousands of Ukrainians trapped in the sister city of Mirnograd right next to it. There's another grouping in the south in kind of a forested patched area. area where Ukraine has been defending for quite a long time. They're now physically surrounded, and Ukraine is fighting really hard on a city called Rodinska. Actually, it's more like a medium-sized town up north of that. They're trying fiercely to try to break through the Russian positions to try and open up a corridor so that those troops in Mirnograd can escape. It remains to be seen whether they'll succeed on that. They haven't in many other areas because Russia, according to General Sirsky from the Ukrainian Armed Forces, has about 150,000 reserve forces in the area. And if Ukraine starts to have success there, it seems reasonable to presume that Russia would flood those reserves in and close that off. If Russia is completely able to close the pinchers and Ukraine can't unblock it, it's not just the loss of the city, the political loss, but then it'll be the twin cities lost and all the troops that are, trained and profited as well. And it's going to be a real big problem, even bigger than it might seem. And then there's issues going on also in the Kupiansk area. There was overnight, there was reports that Russia had crossed a certain river inside there and taken a rail station that was deep inside Ukraine lines. And then some other areas also on the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk area of the Donetsk. All of this is really starting to get pretty wobbly, and it could be a really ugly winter for not just the people there on the front line, but also back in the capital city and other places. And also, I don't know if you saw in the New York Times is reporting yesterday, there's been this big problem inside the Ukraine government where one of the guys that we were helping funnel money into Ukraine for drone production, turns out he was actually siphoning off the top to the tune of $100 million. He has now fled. There's a manhunt for him. And by the way, he was a really close confidant of Volodymyr Zelensky. So not a good look for the Ukraine side.
And which confirms what many people in my listening audience, and certainly I include myself in this group, what's really happening to all the money? I mean, the fog of war is bad enough, and when you're funding a war, a lot of money can go by the wayside and go missing. We've seen this time and time and time and time and time again with dictators or regimes that we've supported. When they have to flee the country because they get overrun, they end up on a plane with billions of U.S. dollars in currency and live lavish lives in the aftermath. So I can't abide any of that. So do these losses or, impending losses, the what's going on right now with the surrounding of the troops, does that create an opportunity perhaps for Zelensky to maybe say, listen, we can't afford this loss of life anymore. In the name of humanity, we're going to negotiate a peace agreement that it does, in fact, involves the conceding some of the land to the Russians in order to end this bloody conflict? I mean, some point, somebody's got to say that out loud.
No. I don't. I think that we have passed that point because he showed when they refused to give a similar order to preserve their troops in Bakhmut nearly 2 years ago, in Avdiivka, shortly after that in the Kursk operation, where they had this penetration into Russia, which never had any prayer of accomplishing anything for Ukraine. They ended up sacrificing about 70,000 killed. And of course, after 8 months, you couldn't tell they were ever there. It was a complete and total loss. And now here we are in Pokrovsk in the Mirnograd area, the same dynamic. They refused to get them out. Now they're trying belatedly to break them out, but we don't even know that that's what they're doing. They may simply be trying to reestablish it. They may not be trying to get them out. So even if they broke through, who knows whether they would allow their troops to leave. I doubt it. And Zelensky's commentary continues to be really boisterous and kind of in your face. And we're not giving up anything. So, no, I don't think there'll come a point. I think that either we're going to have to pull the plug on him or he's going to take his country to complete destruction.
Well, you kind of anticipated what I was going to ask you along those lines. Let's say a couple of years ago, the idea of U.S. military aid and, of course, European military aid was still a pretty strong concept. We were giving them aid. We were entertaining questions for more missiles, et cetera, et cetera. I think we got the end of our rope on that. We've all talked about supply chain issues, the expense of Patriot missiles versus the actual drones that are being used in war, and the ridiculous notion of using Patriots against drones. Tomahawk missiles, end of the equation. We talk about having to need American soldiers and troops to actually operate those, which is a big red flag for most people. But given what, and again, correct me because you're following this far more closely than I am, it just seems to me that the idea, based on everything you've even said on this, Ukraine is losing, and it seems that all the weapons in the world are not going to better its situation militarily as this war rages on. that maybe that practical reality is kind of settled in somewhere in Ukraine, whether or not Zelensky has. He seems to just be spitting in the wind or something like that. He's not facing reality. So is there a different element perhaps at play here, given the global perception?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, there's an additional problem that cannot be overlooked, and that is the fact that Zelensky is being greatly encouraged and supported emotionally and otherwise by Europe. And you have Keir Starmer of UK, Emmanuel Macron of France, Chancellor Merz from Germany. They are emphatically and enthusiastically saying, no, keep going. Don't stop. And Britain, here's some more Storm Shadow missiles. You can fire deeper into Russia. Here's some other components you need. You can hit Russia's oil infrastructure, et cetera. And they're doing some of that. And on the one hand, you may say, well, that's fair game. You're in a war. They can do that. And that's fine. And as long as it produces something positive for your side and gives you a chance to either succeed or push the Russians back. But if all it does is infuriate the Russians and it's not a fraction enough to change the dynamics, then all you do is increase the chance that Ukraine will be crushed and there won't be a negotiated settlement. There'll just be a defeat. That's what I really have a problem. So it's not just Zelensky, but it's the European leaders who are definitely detached from reality.
So you confirm what I was thinking in the back of my mind, in spite of, they continue to encourage a man who's delusional, which suggests they too are delusional with regard to the perception of the war.
Either they're delusional or they're just unconcerned about the cost on the Ukraine side. And as long as they can get people to hit Russia and cause them pain on the way out, they're okay with it, which then you get into these just flat immorality of it. And I fear we're as much in there as we are delusion.
Or maybe we're missing a little piece here because, of course, we've issued tons and tons of sanctions on Russia. We're trying to prevent them from selling their oil in the open market. We're trying to impact their economy. Maybe these quick hits and strikes on, energy production facilities and oil facilities that may not mean a whit, militarily speaking, is having a greater impact on Russia's economy, thus achieving a broader objective.
If there was some evidence to that, then that would be legitimate, because that is a legitimate concept, but only in so far as it actually works.
Yeah.
And when you have seen 19 rounds of if sanctions not have any effect whatsoever on the front line, and you can draw a logical line that number 20, which they're working on right now, and we're talking about literally just yesterday, if 19 failed, maybe 20 will work. It's absurd. And then what you can't do with what these sanctions are is draw a line to how that's going to impact Russia that would in any way affect the political decision-making in Moscow. As a matter of fact, all it's doing is doubling down the certainty within Russia and within the political realm that there's no talk in here. All we need to do is completely win. So it's having literally the opposite effect, and you can observe it. So now we seem to return back again to the delusional thing. We want this to work, so we're just going to pretend that it will, even though evidence screams that it won't. So we have some really big problems in the West.
Straight talk from you, man. We can always count on that. So I love having you on the show. Daniel Davis, Deep Dive. Follow him wherever to get your podcast.